Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Well, are we heading into World War III? I want to get into this at some in some depth in the third hour of our program. How is it that a decision that Franklin Roosevelt made may be leading directly, and not just Roosevelt, every president since him, may be leading directly to the situation in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia? And what does that have to do with oil, and how does that tie into Iraq, and how is it possible that we've even started World War III by invading Iraq? We'll get into that in our third hour. In our second hour, Donna Wisner-Keen is going to be with us. She's with the Independent Women's Forum. We're going to be comparing the tax plans of Barack Obama and John McCain and talking in general about tax policy in the United States and how it should be working. Should be a fascinating discussion. And to start our program, and we'll, you know, there's a number of other things I want to get into here as well. The economic situation in the United States and around the world, the oil situation. There's a lot going on. There's just a lot going on. And one of the main things is this subtext to the McCain campaign that is suggesting that the Obama campaign, when Barack Obama said, "I don't look like the guys on the dollar bill," that he was injecting race into the campaign, and the McCain camp jumped all over that with both feet. And is this now going to become a campaign of race? In the midst of this, we find David Duke, the former Ku Klux Klan leader in Louisiana, the state legislator, and now former presidential candidate and author of two books, My Awakening and Jewish Supremacism. He's the president of EURO, the European American Unity and Rights Organization, an organization for European American patriots, as they describe themselves. He teaches in Eastern Europe. His website is davidduke.com. David Duke, welcome to our show.
I'm glad to be here. I realize I always get introduced as former Ku Klux Klansman David Duke. That was 30 years ago. You know, Robert Byrd, as you probably know, was a former Klansman. He's not introduced that way, though, but I guess that's because he's become a liberal and haven't become a liberal yet. However,
well,
I have a lot of...
You know, I look at your website, and what I see is, look out, the Jews are coming, look out, the black people are coming, and that's sort of the message of the Klan. So, are you renouncing the Klan?
I don't think that's the message at all, but I do think that Israel has an incredible influence on the American political scene, and I think Israel has led us to disaster in the Iraq war. I think they went to war in Iraq specifically because Israel wanted it. It was a war for Israel, not a war for oil. We didn't get one drop of oil out of this war. And the entire coterie of the so-called neoconservatives, Jewish extremists like Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz and the rest of these people, those are the two main architects of the war. Yeah. They're very strong Israeli partisans. And
well, we're going to have to agree to disagree on that, David, because I think I can, and in fact, I intend to, in my entire third hour today, to lay out the evidence that it was a war for oil, and that in fact our presence in the Middle East is really all about oil. But what I wanted to talk with you about today is this op-ed that you wrote.
Before we do that, I mean, I really got to say about the oil thing. I mean, I wish I was on. I'd love to debate that specific subject for.
Yeah, well, we can discuss that some other time.
Oil companies did not lobby for this war. The oil companies did not lobby. AIPAC lobbied for it. The 64 Jewish presidents lobbied for the war. Specifically, Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz wrote a paper for Israel.
David, let me just stop you right here. We invited you on the program to talk about your you're saying Obama is a visual aid for white Americans who just don't get it yet, that we white people have lost control of our country, and unless we get it back, we're heading for complete annihilation as a people. I mean, if you want to turn, if you want to do a rant on anti-Semitism, you know, and you want to get into all of that, we can do that some other time. Give me at least 30 seconds to get ready for it. But
I don't think anti-Semitism is being opposed or Israeli policies and anti-Semitism.
No, but you know, looking at your website, I would say that you're the definition of it. But that's a separate issue. I'd like to talk. Well, actually, it's not. It's another form of racism. And here's I would submit to you that the people that who have been taking advantage of let me just toss out a sentence here, and then I'll let you speak. Okay. I would submit to you, David Duke, that the people who have been taking advantage of poor and middle-income white people, the people to whom you have been appealing, are actually named Rockefeller and Bush and Paulson and Lay and Tillerson, and that their high priest was once named Nixon, who said that he was going to play the race card, and then Reagan, who kicked off his campaign in a racially charged place, in a racially charged way, and now Karl Rove. They're stealing all the wealth from all of us. And as working class whites and poor whites get poorer and poorer, they then play the race card, trying to get people to think that the people of a different ancestry, a different religion, or a different skin color are the cause of our problems or of your problem.
I'd say
you're afraid of the wrong people, David. It's time to wake up.
I think you're partially right. I think there's no question about the fact that these people have used white America. Even Ronald Reagan said that he was opposed to affirmative action. And yet the affirmative action got bigger during his presidency. And affirmative action is racial discrimination against white people. That's what it is, against better qualified white people, including many poor white people, in favor of middle-class black people, because it's certainly Jesse Jackson's son.
Right, so this is another example of how as the pot gets smaller, as they tighten the screws by busting unions.
I think both blacks and whites have been exploited.
You still there? Apparently we have lost Mr. Duke. Okay. Well, anyhow, Chris and Lauren are going to try and get him back on, but I think this is the point, and this is the way that the McCain camp is playing this. Their latest campaign ad that is pointing toward women and talking about how, you know, times are tough and all this kind of stuff. This is another one. This is the way that the Republicans have been able to gain power in the United States. And frankly, before the 1960s, particularly in the South, the way the Democrats did it was by exploiting poverty, exploiting the fears of people who couldn't work, people who couldn't get a job, exploiting poverty, going after and saying, you know, it's not the fault of the wealthy corporations. It's not the fault of the big companies that are busting the unions. It's not the fault of the Walton family, you know, the very, very wealthy families who are skimming everything off the top. It's the fault of those black people who are stealing your job. That's the pitch that's been made. David, you're back with us.
I don't blame the black people for the condition that we are in this country. I blame primarily white politicians who sold out both the white and the black people of this country for lots of policies which are damaging both. But I also don't agree with discrimination against white people in this massive discrimination called affirmative action. I also don't think that we should have an immigration policy that is meant to make white people a minority in this country and really lose the
Why does it matter the color of people's skin? I mean, we've got people who are white, brown, red, yellow, all across the spectrum in this country who hold values that are absolutely core American values. Why does it matter?
I'm not so concerned about the color of skin. In fact, I know a lot of white people who have very dark skin because they tan a lot. It's not color of skin. It's the idea that our culture, our heritage, our way of life, even our unique identity. Why does it matter? Why does it matter to Tibet that massive Chinese immigration will destroy the unique character of the Tibetan people, their religious
background? Because they're a separate nation.
China is a
repressive dictatorship. China is coming in and murdering people in Tibet. I, you know, I don't see African Americans who, by the way, Europeans brought to this continent originally. I don't see African Americans as some sort of, you know, evil force in America. I mean, why not try to bring together people in this country and heal this country rather than exploit the divisions?
I'm not saying that they're an evil force. All I just said was, and you're not really listening to what I say. I guess you've got this prejudice about what I stand for by how the media defines me. What I'm saying is that if a people go from a majority population of 90% to a minority and eventually a small minority, they lose the structure, the character of their society, the same way that Tibet will lose the character and structure of their society with massive Chinese immigration. It's the same principle. I don't want to say
it's really not. The comparison with Tibet is nonsense, David. Tibet, you're talking about an invasion of a foreign country that's bringing a different language, that is outlawing a religion, that's murdering people, that's doing away with cultural traditions. Here in the United States, you've got a lot of people of Hispanic ancestry, you've got a lot of people with African American ancestry who revere our Constitution, who believe in the principles of this country, who love this country.
Listen, I know there's lots of black people who love this country. I'm not trying to hurt them or in any way.
Why are you saying that Obama's election will be a clear signal to millions of our people? He's a visual aid for white Americans who don't get it yet that we've lost control of our country.
Because he stands for every principle against which is in the best interest of the white Americans. You know, McCain or anybody else.
Wait a minute. How is the interest of white Americans any different than the interest of black Americans?
You want me to answer your questions, you're going to have to give me a chance. I mean, I try to answer it, and within the middle of a sentence, you interrupt me.
Okay, look, we got a minute left, David. You can have it.
Well, again, if people want to see what I think about these things, I guess they're going to have to go to my website, davidduke.com. They really can't get it much on the show. But every candidate is asked by the media every day in the campaign, what are you going to do for the black community? What are you going to do for the Hispanic community? Nobody says, what are you going to do for the white community? White people have interests, too. We have a heritage in this country. If we become a small...
You know, I heard that constantly, where people, you know, Chris Matthews referring to the white community as ordinary people. I mean, the question over and over again was, you know...
They don't say white people. They might order you because what's going on here is you've got a reverse discrimination. You've got a discrimination going on against white people in America, and we are losing this country. And Obama is a symbol of that. This guy is best friends with two communist terrorists, Bernardine Dorn and Lou Ayers. He's been a member of a black racist church that says they're loyal to Africa. Yeah, he is a symbol that we're losing this country. You better wake up and fight. DavidDuke.com.
Okay, DavidDuke.com is the website. David Duke. Yeah, thanks for dropping by and talking with us, David. I appreciate you coming on the show. Okay, we'll schedule that for another time. 18 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. Talk radio for smart people. The New Republic had a piece by John Judas recently called The Big Race. And it was very, very interesting, very thoughtful. He talked about how because most white people in America have never experienced racial discrimination, their understanding of racial discrimination is purely in the abstract. It's an intellectual understanding. It's not an emotional understanding. It's not grounded in experience. And so when they're accused of racism, which is, I mean, at core, I think all of us at some level have some have some racism. Let's just be honest. Everybody is aware of the other. It's, I think it's frankly wired into us. It's part of the survival instinct. It's part of the, you know, family first kind of thing. You know, protect your family, then protect your community. So people who look different or who talk different or who behave different or in the case of like, you know, Northern Ireland, who have a different religion, you know, wherever there's an other, there's a potential for conflict. And so those people who have historically had the power and not experienced the discrimination, when they're accused of being discriminators, particularly when they don't perceive themselves to be, even though they're part of a system that very much is, and even though they may well be, but they just don't realize it, they don't understand it, when they're accused of it, you get a strong negative emotional response from them. So a very powerful way to evoke a racist response from whites is to accuse them of being racist. Now, Barack Obama has not done that. But John McCain is claiming that Barack Obama has done that. And by doing so, it is a politically and socially acceptable way to play the race card. In fact, this is what McCain said Obama was doing. Playing the race card. In other words, saying that we're all us white guys are racists. And Obama has been as far away from that. I mean, you know, he has made his entire campaign about staying away from that issue. After all, his mother was white. He was raised in a white family. If there's anybody out there who understands both the white community and the black community and understands how racism really works in the United States on both sides, it's Barack Obama. I mean, who actually has a real and genuine, I mean, what an extraordinary and rare opportunity in life this guy has had to see it from both sides. He really gets it. But what Karl Rove gets, who's unofficially running the John McCain campaign and his buddies officially running it, what they get is that they've got to stimulate the white racist voters. Now, David Duke does it in a way that is overt, just like with his anti-Semitism. It's overt. He's just right out there honest about it. And that, frankly, doesn't work so well. That's why they really don't want David Duke and his friends speaking on behalf of the campaign. That's why the conservative websites, by and large, they'll link to it. They'll talk about it, you know, for their 5-10% fringe. But for the average white folk that they want to get, where they want to cause them to think of Obama first as a racial figure and then secondly as a politician and as a human being, they're going to accuse him of using the race card. That's how they do it.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Call him now at 866-303-2270.
Four minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. Viagra for your brain. Speaking of Viagra, one of its more prominent customers, Silvio Berlusconi, he has skipped the opening ceremony in Beijing. Silvio Berlusconi, for those of you who don't know, what do you do when you're a small-time crook and corrupt businessman? Well, you buy a newspaper, and then you buy a radio station, and then you buy a TV station, then you buy another radio station, then you buy another TV station, another newspaper, and then you buy a radio network, and then a TV network. This is sort of starting to sound like Mitt Romney in a way. In any case, and then you buy another radio network, and then pretty soon when you own all the radio, all the private radio and television networks in the country and most of the major newspapers, you run for prime minister. Yeah, and you win. That's what Berlusconi did. Well, he decided not to attend the opening ceremonies, not because of human rights, but because it's just too hot. Just too hot. 866-3-Beer-Lasconi alert for the day. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And let's see here. John in Gainesville, Florida. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Yes, I just want to comment that most white people, or a lot of white people, realize that racism still exists, but they choose to not accept it because America is still a very racist country. And I wonder what Obama camp plans to do to overcome the racism that exists in America.
You know, there was a time, John, in the late 19th century, and there have been some good stories and books written about it, movies made. Leonardo DiCaprio made a movie, The Gangs of New York, about it, when the war wasn't between white and black. I mean, that war was going on, too, but the war in New York City, anyway, by and large, was between Italians and Irish. And, you know, literally, one side would kill the other. They were, again, competing for jobs. It was all about economics. It was about, you know, the man keeping people down, as it were. And there was such hatred in these communities, and you still find in the Northeast, you still find communities that are virtually entirely ethnically divided, white communities that are entirely, you know, Irish Catholic or Italian Catholic or British Protestant or, you know, and, you know, very, very separate, and they have, you know, low level conflicts between them. There was a change. There was a transformation that happened in those communities, by and large, in the late 30s and early 40s in the 20th century. And it came about because the middle class emerged. As poverty lessened in those communities, they stopped fighting with each other and they went to work. And when they went to work, they started working with each other side by side in the workplace. And it caused them to no longer see each other as the competitors for jobs and no longer hate each other. And I think, frankly, that same kind of thing is, I hope, is going to be the future of the larger race relations, the color race, as opposed to individual national origin relations in the United States. That if Barack Obama becomes president and if he follows the policies of Franklin Roosevelt that brought us the middle class, and if we get card check in the Employee Free Choice Act so that unions can actually form, if we see bottom-up economics, you know, there's a new book out, Obamanomics, and it's about how he believes instead of trickle-down from the top, that just creates a nation of peons. Instead, you have bottom-up economics. You give everybody the economic power, and that stimulates the economy. And he's right. I believe that if that happens, and America goes back to work, and America goes back to work in a multiracial way rather than in a separate, rather than a discriminated way as it was in the 40s and 50s, where while the Italians and the Catholic the Irish and the Italians could work side by side in the 50s, but the Irish or the Italians couldn't work side by side with African Americans because we had legal discrimination, we had, you know, apartheid in the United States. Legally up until the 60s. So this time, if everybody can get back to work and be working together, I think that you'll see a diminution of that racism, just like you see in the military. You know, there's people in the military, whites and blacks by and large in the military, because there's such a racial integration there, and everybody's working together and everybody's got the same pay. Racism is radically reduced. So, John, that would be my take on it. Thanks a lot for the call and raising the issue. I think it's an important one. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan on WTKG. Hey, Rick.
Yes, Tom, enjoyed the interview with David Duke. It's good that you, being a liberal progressive, would allow him to speak. He made some factual errors. He said that no one introduces Robert Byrd as the former Klansman. Sean Hannity does it all the time.
Sure.
And he also interviewed David Duke one time, and it was a real softball interview, by the way, by Mr. Hannity.
Yeah.
Also, he said Lou Ayers, who's an old movie actor, it was Bill Ayers and Bernadette Dorn.
Yeah.
But the more important one, those are kind of
true. And he said that they were Obama's best friends and just not so. I'm sorry.
True. But the thing about affirmative action, Obama just recently, and I think this is very commendable of him, and I think it's because he is biracial. I think, unfortunately, many black people look at him and say, he's one of us, we're going to vote for him. And a lot of white people say, oh, he's one of them, we're not going to vote. He's biracial, folks. He had a black father and a white mother. And for that reason, as you said, he has an excellent outlook on the communities, on both the white and black community. And he said, affirmative action, you know, he isn't totally disowning it, but here's what he said, and I really think this is very salient. He said that we have to also remember there are poor white people. And he says, maybe we should focus more on class. He says, certainly, I don't want my children to be beneficiaries of affirmative action. And people would say, well, why not? Well, because, quite frankly, and they've worked for it, don't get me wrong, nobody handed it to them, but Michelle and Barack Obama are very successful people. Not just black people, they're successful people. And their kids probably should not be given any advantages in applying for school or anything else, because, quite frankly, I know the Obamas are more well-off financially than I am, and God bless them. But this is the thing I think he's focusing on. This is why I think he's such a common-sense good candidate, and it's why McCain and his people have to drag this guy down, because on the merits, Obama should win in a landslide.
Yeah, absolutely, Rick, and well said. And by the way, I thank you for the call. I just want to add to that. Yesterday, you know, on Face the Nation, I guess it was, the big question was, you know, well, why isn't Obama doing better? Well, first of all, I'd say Obama may not be doing better in the polls because probably 10-15% of the electorate isn't even being polled because there are people under 30 whose primary phone is a cell phone, number one. But number two, had an interesting conversation, and I'm not going to name him because I should have asked him at the time, do you mind if I talk about this on the air? I'm sure he wouldn't mind, but I didn't ask, so I'm not going to. But with a friend of mine who has been very active for many years in progressive politics and helped start one of the big organizations that watches the media and used to be on CNN a lot. And he said back in the day, you know, back 10, 20 years ago, CNN, they shared with him some of their viewership figures. And when there was a political crisis or a world crisis, CNN's viewing figures went through the roof. And when there wasn't a crisis, they crashed through the floor. And I would submit to you, and this is not what he said, this is my hypothesis, is that the people, the good people at CNN and the news bureaus of other news agencies, once they figured this out, but particularly CNN and MSNBC, and they looked at this and they said, okay, now we see how it works. If there is a crisis or if there is a horse race, then we get higher ratings. And I would submit to you that the reason that the Obama-Clinton race went on as long as it did was because of the news media. That the reason that every time Kerry started really pulling ahead in the polls, he got knocked back down, and for that matter, every time Bush started doing well in the polls, he got knocked down, was because of the news media. That the news media, and that the reason why the Obama-McCain race right now is 50-50 is because of the news media. Because they want it that way. Because they know. CNN knows. MSNBC knows. I mean, Chris Matthews, he came right out and said this a couple of times on his show where he was talking about the Clinton-Obama thing. And he said, you know, my bosses are telling me that you know, to make this thing last as long as it can. And they know that if Obama had a 20-point lead right now, Americans would stop watching cable news. There's no horse race. They'd say, okay, Obama's going to win. I'm going to go back to work. You know, who's playing football? And so I would submit to you that the press has been manipulating this election. And racism is one of the things that they're using to do it, in fact. Anna in Greeley, Colorado. Hey, Anna, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Got a minute here before the break, by the way. I'm
okay.
Sorry.
Well, I just wanted to say to point out that racism and sexism are institutionalized in Western culture. They're there. And when I was a child and lived in Jim Crow times, I realized it was a poison that you had to push out and get rid of. You can't get rid of all of it, but it's there in the speech,
yeah,
and in all the culture. And by the way, I'd like to also point out that Obama is also half white.
Yeah, that was Rick's point.
This is a measure of racism that we call him black. And
yeah,
when I lived in Oklahoma, we had a bunch of kids who belonged to the Kiowa tribe, and they went to school with us, but the black kids didn't.
Yeah.
So it's not racism.
Racism has been, I mean, this country was founded in racism. It was founded in slavery. Anna, thank you very much for the call. And you know, we have to acknowledge that. And isn't it time we began getting past it? Maybe the way to get past it is to lift up the rug and make the cockroaches scurry away. 45 minutes past the hour.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Before the hour. Hey, a quick reminder, by the way, this Saturday, I will be in Seattle, the Moving Forward What Now Roundtable Forum at the Seattle Center Exhibition Hall, Talk 1090 putting on. Tickets are already sold out for that. I'll be on Radio Row for both the Democratic and Republican conventions on August 26th at 6 p.m. in Denver. I'll be giving a talk and signing books at Borders Books in Lone Tree, Colorado, in the Park Meadows Mall, and the information about that on our website at tomhartman.com. Just click on our calendar, and you'll find it. And September 2nd, AM 950, also on our calendar, the Voice of Minnesota invites you to a party for change. Bill Press, Stephanie Miller, Jim Ward, Chris Lavoie, Ed Schultz, me, John Elliott, Bill Press and I will be doing book signings. The doors open at 5:30, party till 9:30. And this is at the Bear Crossing on the Lake, located in this historic Como Westside or Lakeside Pavilion. Tickets are $10 at the door only. And you can get more information also at the website for AM 950. And I'm sorry, I don't have that right in front of me. Do either of you know the... Okay, we'll get that during the next break. Anyhow. By the way, Fang has turned into a pussycat. Yesterday, I was watching the news, and this little cat that constantly chews on people climbed up on my chest and fell asleep. He's gotten really Fang has turned into a friendly little kitten. But the fat cat in New Jersey, who drew attention across America for his mammoth size, now has a home. Prince Chunk, the 44-pound cat who was abandoned by his owner because she was, as I recall, rendered homeless. She lost her home in a foreclosure or something close to that, has now found a home, has been adopted. In fact, over 400 people have applied to adopt her, or him, as the case may be. And so a fine thing it is. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And let's see, Prez in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Prez, listening on Green 960. What's up?
Good morning, Tom.
Hey.
Hey, I have a theory, and it goes back to the money, about the media and the horse race aspect of it. I believe that, I've been telling these people this for a long time, if you really want somebody to win, you need to vote for that person. They might actually have a chance, like Kucinich, an example. But the reason I think we were given Hillary and Obama by the media largely, and I know there's a lot of support for him, that people are kind of unrealistic what they expect Obama to be able to do. And here's the thing about the media and the advertising. They pump them up to make it a horse race. They get advertising money from the candidates. It goes back into their coffers, and then it can justify more of the same thing. It's just a nice little symbiosis they have going.
Oh, it very much is, Prez. I disagree with the conspiracy theory that the media gave us Hillary and Obama, but I subscribe to the conspiracy theory that the media stretched that thing out a whole lot longer than it probably should have gone. And you're right. Look at the media interest. Look at who benefits from all this. The media. I mean, they're making a fortune in advertising from this, and they're making a fortune in eyeballs from it. And yeah. Absolutely. Well said. Thanks, Press. Len in New York City. Hey, Len.
Hi. The first thing, every time I hear people say that Barack Obama is half white, you know, until his face was known, when he's walking down the street, he was black to anybody who was looking at him.
Yeah.
So, you know, the half white doesn't matter in any respect. But, you know, he is focusing on class distinctions, to his credit, that's really, I mean, you know.
Well, I think that's because he is half white. I mean, it does matter in as much as his experience of growing up was rather unique for somebody who, from the outside, would be identified by most Americans as an African American. His experience growing up was, you know, in the white community. And then his experience as a young man, you know, and in college and as a community organizer was in the African American community. Here's a guy who has seen both worlds from the inside, who has.
I don't think so. I think you have to give all the credit to his intellect, the fact that he understands what's going on, and his experiences are just his experiences, but he knows a heck of a lot more about life than just his experiences.
Yeah, Len, I would suggest you read Dreams of My Father's, Barack Obama's autobiography, his story of growing up, because I think it'll change considerably your perspective on him and how he grew up and what all this meant to him. Jeff, and I think it's a genuine book. Jeff in Detroit, Michigan, and listening to WDTW. Hey, Jeff.
Yeah, hi. I just respond to what David Duke said right at the end of his interview. Yeah. I couldn't really believe what he actually said, that nobody, like politicians or the media, does not care about the concerns of white voters. I know he's been in Europe, like he said like recently, but I don't know where he's been in the last 9 months, because the only...
Well, he was in northern Italy when we were talking to him.
The only voters that were of any concern in the Democratic primary process were, quote, white working class voters. Those were
right.
The only voters that were any legitimate, no other voters.
Yeah, and matters. That phrase was used at least two or three times every single day on all the cable
right,
shows
right.
for months.
And I mean, you could say that it was just this election, but I don't even think that's true because, I mean, as I know here in Michigan, we fought this battle and lost painfully. I voted for Ron Paul on January 15th because we had no vote on the Democratic side. The primary process is controlled, this corrupt primary process is controlled by two 90% rural white states. So I don't even buy the line that nobody cares. Normally, abnormal year that normally nobody cares about white voters. I would say normally they do care about white voters because the primary process is controlled.
Normally they take them for granted, I think would be a better way to say it, Jeff. But, you know, your point is well made. Sandra in Sacramento. Sandra, just a few seconds here before we've got to wrap up this hour. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's fine. I just think that white people are operating under some serious delusions in this country, and they're dangerous. They're dangerous to me as a person of color because we don't set the agenda. They do. And to say that Obama is half white is a low. He's seen as black. He may have other experiences, but what I see is a black person, and that's how this country operates.
Yeah, and when he's trying to flag a cab in New York City, he's got the same problem any other person, you know, of the same skin color would have.
Right, I'm just saying, I know he has different experience, but, you know, let's be real about what's going on.
But as a president, as somebody who's governing this nation, I think that he has, my point was that he has the experience of both sides, or a better understanding, perhaps, of both sides than somebody who was entirely white and grew up entirely white.
Yeah, but how does that translate for people of color, though? Anyway.
Well, I think it's a good thing ultimately.
This is Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Donna Wisner-Keene is with us. She's a senior fellow at the Independent Women's Forum and CEO of Braintrain LLC. IWF.org is the website for the Independent Women's Forum. And Donna, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Glad to have you with us. There we go. I can hardly hear you, but...
You're not coming in clearly either.
There you go. Okay. Well, hopefully we can amp it up on both ends.
That's right.
Okay. Donna, I wanted to talk with you about, you know, Independent Women's Forum is a conservative organization, and broadly my sense of it and my conversations with previous people from the IWF has been that you all are in support of John McCain's tax policies. And... there's two things about this that just befuddle me, just totally baffle me. And perhaps you can enlighten me. I would submit to you, and I suspect you would agree, perhaps not. I would submit to you that the tax policies that we have been following ever since Reagan dropped the top marginal rate from 70% down into the 20s have been, you know, with the singular exception of a couple of years during the Clinton administration when taxes were raised, income taxes were raised, has been not a tax policy, but a credit policy. We have been running this country on a credit card. And that Reagan's policy, Bush Sr.'s policy, and Bush Jr.'s tax policy have actually not been to reduce taxes, but to raise taxes on our children and grandchildren, borrow the money in their name without their consent, reduce the amount of money that you and I, and particularly wealthy people, are sending to the government, call that a tax cut, and in fact drive us into debt. And I don't understand how anybody can even call that a tax policy, much less a rational tax policy.
Is that one question or 20?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a concept.
Yes, I understand. First off, let me say that, the Independent Women's Forum includes a lot of independent women. We don't all have the same ideas. We don't all share the same views. And to say that we support John McCain's tax policies is a little bit of a stretch. Many of us tend to be more conservative from where you're coming from, but that doesn't mean that we all just lockstep support.
Well, your president, Michelle Bernard, identified the group yesterday on the McLaughlin program as a conservative women's organization.
We tend to be more conservative, but that doesn't mean that each woman supports John McCain's tax policies or each woman supports all the conservative views.
Okay, but you wanted to come on the show to defend John McCain's tax policy specifically, did you not? Okay, so please respond then to my assertion.
first off, I do support John McCain's spending cuts. He would not consider himself necessarily a tax cut person. For example, he voted against Bush tax cuts twice. What he does is he considers himself an anti-spending candidate, and he's been consistent against spending for the government. So
we've got a trillion-dollar debt or deficit,
right?
Annual. The actual real annual deficit is $1,000 billion when you include the cost of the war that's off the books, when you include the money we're borrowing from Social Security that's off the books, when you include the emergency appropriations that are off the books, and you include the actual deficit, you know, which is over $600 billion.
I agree with you.
So we've got $1 trillion. What are you going to cut from the federal government to the tune of $1 trillion a year?
You know, I can't answer that question. What I can tell you is that John McCain has sincerely been against spending for an awful long time.
No, but where are you going to cut $1 trillion? I mean, you've got the education department's only an $18 billion department, as I recall. All of your welfare programs, where you're talking about direct payments, if you cut off every, you know, single mother in America who is getting child support from the government, you know, AFDC, that's less than $20 billion. I mean, I don't see how, even if you slashed all, you know, federal aid to education, everything, I don't see how you can even come up with $100 billion, much less $1,000 billion, which is what our debt is right now, or our annual deficit, $1 trillion. I don't see where it's going to come from.
Well, actually, what I would prefer is to see some simplified tax system and some zero-based budget and start talking about where we're going to cut instead of doing what the Obama tax plan, which would balloon the deficit, according to the Washington Post yesterday. And so if you compare John McCain and Obama, you get Obama's tax and spend old Paul system, and then you get John McCain, who is at least willing to talk about some spending cuts.
But McCain wants to keep in place Bush's tax cuts. McCain wants to borrow and spend. I'm all in favor of tax and spend. That's what this government was founded on. You spend an amount equal to what you tax.
Okay, well, we've already spent way more than that, so now we're going to have
right.
to
we're doing borrow and spend.
Spending less.
Right. Well, or we have to pay more taxes. I mean, you know, the country was running really fine during Dwight Eisenhower's Republican presidency when the top marginal tax rate was 91%.
Well, he had the advantage of a Republican Congress, too, and now you've got a tax and spend Congress. Look, during the Depression, you had the government out of money, but you had people with money. Now you've got people in debt, and you've got the government in debt. So what you had was a tax rebate system that just cost us $80 billion so we can meet out $600 per family that was our money in the first place. So now you're going to be spending, for the rest of your life, you're going to be spending interest on that $80 billion permanent debt to the government. That
right. In other words, it wasn't our money in the first place. It, just like you know, $1 trillion a year of other government spending, it was money that we've borrowed in the names of our children that we gave to ourselves. Only this time it was given to the middle class instead of to people who are millionaires and billionaires, as George Bush did, particularly with his cut on capital gains and dividends.
I did lobby for the Bush tax cuts in 2001. Let me just give you an example. And in fact, it's in the Washington Post on Saturday, but it hasn't been widely reported. And I just talked to the Senate Budget Office this morning about it. It's a $1.4 billion new tax, basically, by the Congress. And that is, you used to be able to live 2 out of every 5 years in a house and then get a capital gains relief so that you could have, as your retirement plan, your own house. The housing market is obviously in the dumps. It's caused us almost a recession. It's thrown a lot of people out of work, and it's only going to get worse. And what they did was they said, okay, no longer are you going to get your capital gains deduction anymore if you live 2 or 5 years. We're just going to cut that off on January 1st. Now, you ask the average American if he can plan for retirement when the Congress is completely changing and finding every means to tax us. So I know you agree, you think that maybe we should not cut the government and we should tax more, but at some point you have to say, are all of us going to live on our own Social Security for the rest of our life? Or are we going to try to save? And when people give up trying to save because they know inflation's coming, for example, with the $1 trillion debt you talked about, then we have people not being productive, and that's a way to economic ruin. I mean, we've seen that happen in Chile and Peru and Russia. What Russia did to increase their economy is they went to a flat tax, a simplified flat tax, so you knew how much you were spending. And they
what Russia did to increase their economy is they went to an oligarchy, and what the flat tax produced was massive poverty. I mean, I've been there. You've got people begging in the streets. You've got 12-year-olds prostituting themselves in the streets. I mean, Russia, at the same time that limousines are driving by with all the new oligarchs in them, Russia has become, like America was in the 1880s, a nation of robber barons and working poor, period. I mean, it's destroyed the Russian economy, the average working person in Russia.
The tax didn't destroy the economy. The fact that they didn't cut
the tax allowed the oligarchs to emerge. One of the reasons that Dwight Eisenhower, the Republican, was so in favor of a 91% top income tax rate, and he spoke out about this, was because it prevented the emergence of extreme wealth. Wealth that to quote Thomas Jefferson would be dangerous to the state. To quote Alexander Hamilton, quote James Madison in the constitutional debates. There was a whole debate in July of 1787 about how to deal with the possibility of the emergence of great wealth that could threaten the state in the United States. They thought that doing away with the laws of primogeniture would solve the problem. You know, the ability of the oldest son to inherit everything from his father.
And if you actually believe in any of the Christian tenets, they say the poor you will always have with you and the wealthy you will always have with you.
That's no rationalization. If you believe in that, then you need also to go to Matthew 25 where Jesus says, you know, they said to him, how are you going to get into heaven? And he said, you know, the only way that you're going to get into heaven is by feeding the poor, is by healing the sick, is by, you know, giving water to those who are thirsty, by visiting those who are in prison. And actually he said, by doing it to me. And they said, they were totally freaked out because none of them had ever seen him hungry or in prison. And they said, you know, how are we going to get into heaven? And he said, as you do it to the least of my brothers, you've done it unto me. I mean, if you're going to invoke Christianity, at least invoke the actual, you know, themes of Christianity.
Okay. And in the Roman Empire, when you were discussing those themes of Christianity, which at that time were very new, your Roman wealthy also gave to charity, but what they did was finance circuses and finance games and then put their names.
No, but Jesus saying that was seditious to the Romans, and by the way, it wasn't new. I mean, those are the tenets that were at the core of Judaism for 1,000 years prior to that.
Right, but not for Roman paganism, and I'm talking about Rome and not the Middle East. So if you keep in the right country, you're going to get it a little better.
We have a half a minute left.
Charity.
Let's bring it back to McCain. You know, again, how can McCain justify saying we're going to cut spending without identifying what the spending is?
How can Obama say that he's going to have a great economy when all he's offering is more taxing for the programs that we've got?
Because if we can make the programs that we've got work well, and if we raise taxes on the wealthy to the point, like during the Clinton administration, that we have a balanced budget, then that's in the interest of this country.
Well, you've got a $7 billion Head Start program that doesn't work, for example. How are you going to make it better by adding money to it? How are you going to make it
actually better? The Head Start program works great. All the statistics show the kids who go through Head Start are more than half less, 50% less likely in later age to end up in jail or unemployed.
No, actually what it does show is that by third grade you can't see the difference between a child that's been in Head Start and a child that hasn't been in Head Start.
Then we're looking at completely different statistics. I'm looking at the Pew statistics.
The problem with the difference between liberals and conservatives.
Yeah, I guess so. Donna Wisner Keene, you can read about it over at IWF.org, the Independent Women's Forum, senior fellow at the IWF. Donna, thanks for dropping by. It's an interesting conversation. 17 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program right here on Air America Radio. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Study funded by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Head Start children performed better on cognitive, language, and health measures than did their comparison group counterparts did. Reliable studies have found that Head Start children have increased achievement test scores and experienced favorable long-term effects on grade repetition, special education, and graduation rates. In fact, a study in California, San Bernardino County, of 600 graduates showed the society receives $9 in benefits for every $1 invested in Head Start children. You know, it just blows my mind. The main conservative talking point is if you cut taxes, you increase revenue. Now, tell me how this makes sense. Now, the way that they say that up is down is they say, well, if you cut taxes, then people are more economically active. That increased economic activity raises the tax collections. And the fact of the matter is that every year our economy does go up, with the exception of the years up leading up to the Republican Great Depression, 1929 to 1934. But pretty much steadily, every year the economy gets bigger. Our population gets bigger. Our economic activity gets bigger. And then they point to John Kennedy and they say, you know, okay, we had a 91% top tax rate for if you earned over $3 million a year on that $301 million that you earned every year, you started paying 91% income taxes. And so this is the reason why from the 1930s until the 1980s, you had very few people who, you know, very few dynastic families emerged. The Bill Gateses, the Walton families, the huge fortunes, like you saw in the 1880s to the 1930s, during the robber baron era, the Rockefellers and the Mellons and the Scaifes and all these huge empires, the Dow family, you didn't see those kinds of fortunes emerge during that period from the 30s to the 80s. And, of course, they were chomping at the bit, and so they wanted to increase taxes. And so what the cons say is, well, you increase taxes. You know, they say Kennedy cut taxes, cut the top marginal tax rate from 91% down to 74%, and wasn't that a good thing? Well, in fact, what Jack Kennedy said he was going to do was that he was going to increase taxes. He called it tax changes in his debate with Nixon. But he said that he was, because he was in the 90% tax bracket, and he knew that nobody paid it because of all these loopholes that had been put in there during the Eisenhower administration by, you know, when the Republicans controlled Congress. And so he said, what we're going to do is we're going to close those loopholes. We'll drop the top rate down to 70% because back then, even at the 91% rate, most people who were really, really rich were only paying in the 60s. And in fact, here he is talking to Richard Nixon in the debates about how he's going to raise taxes and what he's going to do with it.
Third, I think it's possible to gain a $700 million to $1 billion through tax changes, which I believe would close up loopholes on dividend withholding, on expense accounts.
Those loopholes, by the way...
So in my judgment...
Hang on just a second. Those loopholes, by the way, are the very loopholes that George Bush has put into place, right? He dropped the maximum tax rate on dividends and interest down to 15%. So Kennedy closed that up. He did away with that. He said, we're going to see an increase in revenue. In other words, he's promising to raise taxes. And here he summarizes it again.
So in my judgment, we would spend more money in this administration on aid to education. We'd spend more money on housing. We'd spend more money, and I hope more wisely, on defense than this administration has done. But I believe that the next administration should work for a balanced budget, and that would be my intention. Mr. Nixon misstates my figures constantly, which is, of course, his right. But the fact of the matter is, here is where I stand, and I just want to have it on the public record.
So Kennedy dropped the top tax rate from 91% to 70-something percent, and tax revenues went up because he closed the loopholes. He actually raised taxes on the rich. And Reagan came along and somehow convinced Americans with all the right-wing think tanks and all the millionaires in the press that Kennedy dropped taxes by 20%, income taxes, top taxes on the wealthy, and it helped America. It increased our, it led to almost a balanced budget. I mean, you know, it was a good thing. And so let's do it again. And so he drops it from the 70s down to the 20s. And what happens? A disaster, a 30-year disaster. We are now left with a $10 trillion deficit. And all John McCain has to offer is more borrow and spend, put it on the credit card of our children and grandchildren, economic policies, which are destroying this country and are going to continue to destroy this country. And on top of this now, you have the newspapers reporting that the Saudis, the Omanis, the Kuwaitis, all the sovereign wealth funds, they're showing up in America and they're buying not just our businesses, but now they're buying our houses.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call us at 866-303-2270.
Past the hour, truth in broadcasting. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Oh, this is just too good to not share with you. Remember the pit bull Booger that the woman had cloned after he died, her beloved pit bull and the five pups and the whole big international scandal because the Korean doctor did the cloning and all that? Well, turns out when this woman with her five little baby cloned pit bulls was shown on the news from South Korea, her name is Bernan McKinney, she's 57 years old, the folks in the United Kingdom looking at her face got a sudden, whoa, hey, we know who that is. Turns out that she is the woman who back in 1977 fled the United Kingdom and apparently has been hanging out in Korea with her dog Booger because she had, now get this, I am not making this up, had abducted a Mormon missionary in England, handcuffed him to a bed, and made him her sex slave. Look out, Mitt Romney! Oh, man. Police in the UK say, you know, so many years have gone by that they're just going to, they consider it a cold case and they're not going to try to deport her back to the UK to be held to trial. maybe the Mormon missionary doesn't want to testify. I don't know. 36 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Is it Alain in Helsinki, Finland, or Alan?
It's Alan.
Alan. Hey, yeah,
nice to speak with you again.
Thank you for calling.
You're welcome. Well, Tom, I'm always amazed how you can just sit there and let your guests just spew out, I mean, utter nonsense. I mean,
well, look, they have to do it first so I can refute it.
Yeah, I know. But listen, you know, living here in Europe, I mean, I've been living here for 5.5 years now, Tom, and, and if you were to ask me, would you move back to the United States or would you rather stay in Europe? And the answer is simple. I'd rather stay here. The average European has a higher quality of life. We pay higher taxes, but we have services for it. Education in Finland is number one. Buses and trains run, have like a 98% on-time rate. okay? I mean, the food protection is better, the government regulation, we don't have any real estate problems. The only place in Europe where there's a real estate issue is England, because they're kind of doing things like America is doing.
Yeah, they did. Maggie Thatcher, Thatcherism, they've been doing deregulation ever since her, just like we have since Reagan.
And that's right.
Now, Alan, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Alan, there's an article in today's Wall Street Journal. Starts on page one. Students face hit as private lending dries up. A retreat by private sector lenders from the marketing for education loans is threatening to keep thousands of students out of college in the coming academic year. They point out that the increase in private student loans, this is students going to for-profit corporations, which are now starting to offer, by the way, variable interest rate loans, just like the subprime mortgages, where you get your student loan now at 2%, and they may jack it up to 20% 5-10 years down the road, has increased since 1996 989%. It's just exploded. It's a $20 billion a year industry now. We've got all these students so deeply in debt. In Finland, can you go to college for free?
Yes, education is free.
So this is not even an issue. I mean, here it's a crisis in the United States. Kids can't even go to college. And in Finland, what's the tax rate that the average middle class pays there? And what do the riches pay?
Well, Tom, we have it for everything that you talk about on your program. We have it here. We have a progressive tax rate system. As a matter of fact, every year, the top 400 wage earners, their pictures are put in the paper along with their salaries and what their stocks options were and what their taxable rate is. We are consistently ranked by the United Nations as the least corrupt country on planet Earth.
Wow. Wow. And for all of these literally cradle-to-grave benefits, what the conservatives would consider loss of freedoms, what I think most of us progressives would consider the foundation for freedoms, what kind of taxes do you pay?
Well, okay, I'm not a Finnish citizen, okay? And I'm naturally on the lower end of the scale. My wife works for the foreign ministry, and I teach tennis. So right now, I think my taxable rate is maybe 18%. But we have 22.5% value-added tax on everything. Price of gasoline, or as we call petrol here, is about $9.15 a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the society is functioning very well, thank you very much.
Yeah, well, you've had high gas prices for 40 years, though.
Oh, yeah,
so plenty of time to adjust to that.
Yeah, yeah.
Bottom line is taxes are high, you get the services for it, and the vast majority of people in Finnish. Now, is there a debate? Do you have the neoliberals, the Friedmanists, the Chicago school boys?
Hey, yeah, of course we do. Of course we do. They're called the Kokomo's Party, which is the center-right party, and they have taken over the government, but, there's no – if they were to try to affect the healthcare system in any way, they would be thrown out on their keisters faster than you could say, let's go to a commercial.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you very much for the call.
And, you're welcome, Tom.
And thanks for listening to us there in Helsinki, Finland. It's the same story. It's, when we did our show from Copenhagen, Denmark, we were hearing the exact same thing. Greg in Palmdale Beach, Florida. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Hey, how are you? Hey, Tom, I can't believe the students in our country are actually taking all this. I'm a child of the 70s, and I grew up, and I saw it on TV every night, where there was so much activism in this country, and I believe there's so much deactivism.
Well, in 1996, I mean, we're just looking back 12 years ago. In 1996, there were fewer than $2 billion worth of private for-profit student loans written. Last year, it was $18 billion. I mean, it's exploded. And,
yeah.
and I remember, you say you're a child of the 70s. I'm a child of the 60s. I remember in the late 60s hitchhiking out to California with a whole bunch of my friends because everybody was from Michigan where I grew up. Because, half the people I knew were going to California because they could go to college for free there.
Right.
And even at that, I mean, Michigan State University was really cheap. I mean, my wife Louise put herself through college working as a waitress at the Howard Johnsons. For the period of time that I was in college, I was working at a radio station as a DJ, and I was making minimum wage. I think I was making like $1.30 an hour or something like that. You could put yourself through college. I also worked as a waiter in a Bob's Big Boy. I also changed tires in a garage. I worked in a gas station. You know, you do whatever you could do, but you could earn enough money to actually go to college back in the 60s and 70s. And, right. And the idea of borrowing money to go to college was just like unheard of.
Yes.
I mean, it is such a tragedy in the United States. 30 years of, thank you, Greg, 30 years of Reaganomics. Reagan, by the way, was the guy who did away with free public education at the college level in California. And when he was asked why, he said, why should I pay for the college education of people who are just going to protest my policies? I mean, honest to God, that's what he said. Maybe not word for word, but that's the essence of what he said. And it has destroyed. It destroyed California. It's destroying this country. We're no longer competitive. You've got all these other countries. China, about to overtake U.S. as the largest manufacturer in the world. This is from the Financial Times. China is set to overtake the U.S. next year as the world's largest producer of manufactured goods, 4 years earlier than expected. Next year, 17% of all goods manufactured in the world are going to come from China. National Association of Manufacturers, by the way, the big trade group for the big corporations in America, headed up by John Engler. Is that the John Engler who was the former governor of Michigan? I guess so, probably. Played down the effect of the projections. He said it's inevitable. Yeah, well, the big manufacturing companies, they don't care where their stuff is made as long as they can make it cheap and sell it here. Jim in Berkeley, California. Hey, Jim.
Hey, let me come on speakerphone.
Sure.
I'm wondering if you have heard or read and can refute the conservative meme that's been out there that cutting income taxes actually raises income tax revenue. I just found the Heritage Foundation article from 2001
right.
that asserts that. I've seen it a lot, and I think it's my suspicion is it's wrong. But
yeah.
I haven't done the research yet.
Well, the fact of the matter is that when they cut taxes, revenue did go up. And revenue went up for two reasons. One, when you cut capital gains taxes, you had a lot of people. I mean, this in 96, there was a big capital gains tax cut. And I owned a business in 1996, International Wholesale Travel in Atlanta. Louise and I had started this business in 93, and in 96 we had built it up. It was about a $6 million a year business, and we'd been on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. It was a big capital gains tax cut, and so we sold the business and took the money and went and lived in Europe for a year, you know. When you cut capital gains tax and things like that, over the short term you see a boost because a lot of people cash in at the lower tax rate. So there's that. Plus, over time, the economy always is continuously growing, no matter what. You can take that argument that the conservatives use about the Reagan tax cuts increasing revenue, and you can also use the exact same argument for every time taxes have gone up. If you look at the tax increases that Roosevelt did, if you look at the tax increases that Kennedy did, if you look at the tax increases that Johnson did, if you look at the tax increases that Bill Clinton did, they all increased revenue. So you know, it's a classic example of figures don't lie, but liars can figure, Jim. Thanks a lot for the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Visit us on the web at hartmanradio.com.
Minutes before the hour. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service will be with us in just a moment. First, Matt in Los Angeles. I just wanted to get a quick comment from you in here, Matt.
Tom.
Hey, what's up?
Oh, you know, I talking to Republicans, as I often am forced to do, I often quote Milton Friedman, who in his book, Capitalism and Freedom, makes a very powerful statement, and that is that the greatest threat to freedom is the consolidation of power. And really what's been shown over the years is that it's the Republican policies that lead to the greatest consolidation of power by far.
Right. Yeah, and power is economic power. Excellent. Well said, Matt. Thank you very much. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com on the line. Hey, Ellen, what's up?
Well, okay, not a whole heck of a lot. Let's start out with the situation in Georgia. As you may know, the president yesterday told Vladimir Putin that violence was unacceptable. Well, a lot of good that's done.
Now, if I may interrupt you, Ellen, my understanding is that, and I've heard this from kind of off-the-record sources, and maybe you've heard something different. I'd love to find out, that Vladimir Putin basically told George Bush that it was rather obscene to go commit a sexual act with himself, and that Bush got very angry, and that Putin said basically you can't do anything about this.
Well, you know, I did not actually hear that, and that would not surprise me. But of course, Putin is completely behind it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, this, in fact, my entire next hour is going to be about this and oil and the war in Iraq and how it's
all
the same stuff.
Well, we've had Dan at the United Nations today. And as you know, the Security Council met yesterday at 11 o'clock. The Secretary General has been very involved in this. Mm-hmm. And Russia has veto power.
Right. Yeah. So nothing's going to come out of the Security Council about this at all. Because
Zippo,
Russia's
what
in the,
can
on the Security
possibly
Council.
Come out of this? We do know this. A major general today was giving a briefing. Meredith McKenzie was at the Pentagon today, and they are sending the Georgian soldiers are all being sent home, redeployed to Georgia for their country's security.
What do you think the impact of one of John McCain's senior advisors being a lobbyist for Georgia has on his positions or on what, you know, on the Republican position on this? Or are there any kind of partisan positions emerging?
I don't think there really are partisan positions. If anything, Mr. Bush may not want to do anything because it gets in the way of his other goals. But I don't think there's a partisan position. I have to tell you this, though. McCain came out with sort of a 10-point plan or something like that. And the Obama people did not come out with what I would consider as solid a plan. And so McCain, this kind of helps McCain. Maybe it's because his guy knew so much about Georgia.
Yeah, it could be. My sense of this is that this is actually, in a very real way, we brought this on ourselves, that we have been encircling Russia with, with the threat of missiles, you know, this missile shield that Bush wants to put into Eastern Europe. Ostensibly to stop Iran, but the Russians all know that it's to stop Russia, that they're talking about encircling Russia. It would be as if Russia was negotiating with Canada and Mexico to put up a missile shield to protect the United States and everybody else from Guatemala, you know.
Right.
So that's got the Russians freaked out. McCain has called in the past to kick Russia out of the G8. That's got the Russians freaked out. Georgia has been allied with the United States. If Georgia was right now in NATO, we would have it would be like World War One, you know, where when Prince Frederick Alfred or whatever.
We would have to, right, the assassination of Sarajevo.
Yeah, once that was triggered by treaty, we would have to be at war with Russia right now if Georgia was, you know, in NATO. And this is something that the Republicans and the Bushes have been pushing for really, really hard. And McCain has been pushing for really hard. And it just highlights the dangers of this whole region and of poking that bear, literally Russia. My take on it is that Russia is going to try and take not just the two northern breakaway provinces that they've basically, for all practical purposes, had since 93 and 94, but that they're going to try and take Georgia itself.
I think they're going to try and take Georgia itself, and I think that they know there's absolutely nothing the U.S. and the European Union can do about it.
Yeah, and here you got the president
or
of Georgia.
To do about it.
Right, you've got the president of Georgia begging us to do something about it. You've got neocons like Bill Kristol out there and Kagan saying, let's go to war with Russia over this. They never saw a war they didn't like. And Russia's got 9,000 nuclear warheads pointed at us. It's like at what point? But see, on the other hand, you've got the then you've got the oil folks, set, you know, pointing out that there's this massive oil pipeline. You know, it accounts for of the equivalent of maybe about 5% of U.S. oil consumption. It's a fraction of the world's. That runs from the Caspian Sea to the Black Sea, across Georgia.
Well, this is all about it. There's no question.
Yeah, and so what Russia is trying to do is they're trying to position themselves as the next Saudi Arabia. They're trying to be the nation that is going to control the world's oil supply, and thus they'll ultimately control us. At the same time, we've got the Chinese in Africa trying to do the same thing. When you and I were in Sudan, we saw this. You know, the Chinese all over the place. They're pumping oil as fast as they can and cutting deals as fast as they can with all the African countries. And we just created an African command now, a military command, similar to CENTCOM, the Middle Eastern command. And I see more oil wars on the horizon. This really concerns me.
Well, I see more oil wars, too, which is why, actually, they've got to do something our government has got to do something about our dependence on foreign oil. And it's interesting, John Boehner is now describing the Democrats in a panic modality. And he said he's going to go to 18 districts in 6 states, and a lot of them are sort of swing states, in order to get across his point that the Democrats don't really want to do anything about it, really.
Yeah, which is such a lousy meme. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is a very, very serious situation, what's going on in Georgia. And I want to take it, bring it out to the whole great big picture, because the media won't do it. The corporate media won't do it. And the Republican Party definitely won't do it, and the Democrats probably won't do it, because they're all, by and large, to one degree or another, complicit in how this all came about. So let's just kind of play the Wayback Machine here, all the way back to 1860. In 1860, or in the, I think it was 1865 or 1867, the first oil well, Colonel Drake drilled the first oil well in the United States in Titusville, Pennsylvania. The first gusher, and thus began the American era of oil. And we had a hell of a lot of oil in the United States. Pennzoil was the Pennsylvania Oil Company. There were oil wells all over Pennsylvania. There were oil wells all over New Jersey. That's why there's so many refineries there. There were oil wells all over New York. There were oil wells all over Ohio. There were oil wells in Michigan. There were oil wells all across the East Coast and through the Midwest as the search for oil traveled west. And what happened from the 1860s to the 1870s, the 1880s, 1890s, is we started just pumping those wells dry. But we could always discover more. And then we discovered oil in Oklahoma. And then we discovered oil in Texas. And then we discovered oil in California. And the oil, and so there was always more oil. And so right up through World War II, the United States was supplying all of its own oil. And we had, by World War II, we had an entirely oil-based economy. Oil was providing for well over 95, probably more than 99% of our transportation. It was making most of our electricity. We were using coal for some of it, remnants from the 19th century, but mostly it had shifted over to oil. We were using oil for plastics. We were using oil to make fertilizers. We were using oil to make herbicides and pesticides. We were using oil to fuel the machinery of agriculture and transport agricultural goods. We were using oil to manufacture plastics and pharmaceuticals and cosmetics and lubricants. I mean, right across the board, we had and continue to have an economy that existed only because of oil. Virtually everything we did was in some way intricately intertwined with oil. And it was American oil. because the United States was pumping its own oil up until 1945. World War II caused us to use, just in fighting World War II, we used one-third of all the total of all the oil that we had in the United States, of all our oil reserves at that point in time. It was a massive amount of oil we used fighting World War II. But it was one of the things that allowed us to beat the Germans and the Japanese, because Hitler ran out of oil. And Tojo never had any oil to begin with. In fact, there's a good argument to be made that the reason why he struck us at Pearl Harbor is because we had blocked the straits just to the west of Japan, which was the major oil shipping route there, and blocked the shipments of oil into Japan. And they had no choice. So Roosevelt figured this out, and he said, this wasn't rocket science to figure it out, but particularly World War II really brought it to high relief. And he realized that over time, America's appetite for oil was going to be greater than our supply of oil, and that we had to come up with more oil supplies. And around that time, oil was discovered in Saudi Arabia. And what was clear was that that one little country, Saudi Arabia, had more oil than all of the United States. I mean, there's just a massive amount of oil in Saudi Arabia. And so Roosevelt, in 1945, hosted the King of Saudi Arabia. No records were ever kept. There are photos of this. There's documentary evidence, but there was no records kept of the conversations. He hosted the King of Saudi Arabia on a USS aircraft carrier, and the king brought along his slaves and his astrologers and his Bedouin warriors. I mean, this was like, a Bedouin tribe, very, very poor. And the deal that Roosevelt made essentially was, you give us your oil, we'll guarantee, and you let American companies develop your oil, and we will protect you, the king. We will guarantee your power. This is in 1945. And that doctrine was followed by Harry Truman. Truman came out with the Truman Doctrine, which talked about containing communism, but in large part it was code for, we're going to protect the oil supplies of the Middle East. This led to the Eisenhower Doctrine, which said the same thing. All of these guys gave some rather substantive speeches on this issue. But still, we weren't importing that much oil. I mean, we were throughout the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s, we were importing less than 5% of our oil. And then the 70s came, and our oil imports were pushing up into the 20% region, and Jimmy Carter was president, and there was this moment in time. War happened in the Middle East. The Arabs cut off our oil because we supported Israel. We saw a spike in oil prices. Louise and I were living in Detroit at the time. She was pregnant with our oldest daughter. And I remember living in this big city. The stores emptied in about 2 or 3 days. I remember people being shot at the gas stations, people getting in fights and people killing each other in the gas stations because there was no gas. We went to odd even license plates in Michigan. There was just the Teamsters went on strike, and there was no food being delivered to the stores, and the shelves were emptied, and people were hoarding, and this was just because one small part of the world, just a handful of countries, said we're not going to export oil to the United States. And at that time, we were only importing about 20% of our oil. So Jimmy Carter saw this as an opportunity. Jimmy Carter said, I can change the direction of America with this. And this would be a good thing. And so on July 15th, 1979, Jimmy Carter came out and he said, we've got to fundamentally change things. Here we are, we're importing about 20% of our oil from foreign countries, and only a small fraction of that actually was coming from Saudi Arabia, only about 5 or 6%. Most of it was coming from Mexico, from Canada, from Venezuela, from other sources. But nonetheless, he said, we're not going to import any more foreign oil. Here's his speech.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
Now, truth be told, there was a plan B. And the plan B was to have a strong presence in the Middle East. The Shah of Iran was our stabilizing influence in the Middle East. And we had military bases there, and that would protect our oil supplies. But at the same time, Carter put into place a whole series of programs that would reduce our dependence on oil so that we would never import more oil than we had in 1977, when our oil imports were less than 20% of our total consumption. By the way, right now, we're importing about 60% of our oil. Carter went on to say, we're going to do this with electricity as well. And he talked about creating the nation's first solar bank.
I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
So if Jimmy Carter's policies had been followed, we would now, instead of being importing 60% of our oil, and a chunk of that, a sizable chunk of that from the Middle East, we would be only importing 20% of our oil or less, and we would be generating over 20% of our electricity from solar, and obviously wind and all kinds of other things right now. But Carter, that was 1999. The Shah fell, the Middle East got destabilized, and Jimmy Carter left office, and Ronald Reagan came in with all this oil money and all this oil power. And so our addiction to oil continued. Reagan said, just throw the spigots open. He cut another deal with the Saudis. He hosted the Saudis. And we had the Reagan Doctrine. I mean, this was after the Roosevelt, the Truman, the Eisenhower, the Nixon, the Carter, and then the Reagan Doctrine, which was basically, we are going to defend our strategic interests in the Middle East, a.k.a. oil. I mean, the best estimate from conservative think tanks is that just last year, in military force alone, setting aside the Iraq war, we spent over $160 billion defending our oil supplies around the world. That's the price of oil. That's like an extra $5 a gallon on all the gasoline in the United States that we're paying through income taxes instead of gasoline taxes. So how does this take us to what's going on in Georgia? I'll tell you right after the break.
You're listening to Tom Hartmann.
See, that's what we've been doing all over the world. We've been getting what we want. We are 5% of the world's population. We consume 25% of the world's oil. And just 20 years ago, China was an insignificant portion of the world's oil, and they are now in the direction of consuming, we don't have exact figures, but, there's a whole lot of guesses, somewhere between 10 and 20% of the world's oil. I mean, it's absolutely massive. And so anyhow, we were up to Carter, and after Carter, of course, Reagan said, to hell with all this alternative energy stuff. We're going to stay on oil. And then Saddam Hussein takes Kuwait. And George Bush Sr. says, no, it's about the oil.
Our jobs, our way of life, our own freedom, and the freedom of friendly countries around the world would all suffer if control of the world's great oil reserves fell into the hands of that one man, Saddam Hussein.
And there he was. And this is how Bush initially tried to sell the war in Iraq, the first Gulf War. And immediately there was blowback. Americans all over the country. I mean, there were protests. No blood for oil. People holding these signs out. And so very, very quickly, the first Bush administration changed the rationale from, we are going to prevent Saddam Hussein from controlling all of that oil. And Dick Cheney had, in fact, made the comment, Saddam Hussein, Iraq, well, here he is.
Iraq sits.
Yeah, let me just tune this down a little.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
And then he made the point that if Iraq took Kuwait, they would control 20% of the world's oil reserves. And that was intolerable. And so Bush Elder sold the Gulf War as we're trying to free Kuwait, which itself had not been free before. It was a dictatorship before. It's a dictatorship again. But, oh, yeah, we were freeing them. We actually wanted the oil. And then came the war in Iraq. And there was that moment when George Bush Jr. is declaring the war, and he looks at the camera and he says, "And now I'd like to talk to the Iraqi people." And we were all expecting him to say something like, "You know, we got the biggest army in the world. We're going to kick your butts. Just lay down your weapons and nobody will get hurt and it'll be fine. Everything will be fine." But that's not what he said. Instead, he said this.
"Your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells."
And all over the world, people's jaws dropped and everybody got it. In fact, that Operation Iraqi Liberation, which is what the original name was, till they realized that the acronym was rather unfortunate, for Operation Iraqi Liberation, and they changed it from OIL to Operation Iraqi Freedom as soon as the press reported that, you know, that was going to be it. And we got the war in Iraq, which, frankly, is all about oil. Now, you've got, and then, you know, of course, you've had even politicians pointing this out. Here's Hillary Clinton talking about George Bush. Turn it on.
"President Bush is over in the Gulf now begging the Saudis and others to drop the price of oil. How pathetic."
But see, he really had no choice. I mean, that's what it has come to. So now you have Russia industrializing and needing more and more oil, although they also are a major producer of oil. You've got China industrializing and needing more and more oil. China is buying up the oil all over Africa. We have just started AFRICOM. Like CENTCOM was created during the Reagan administration, the U.S. Central Command, to control and regulate the oil supplies of the Middle East. And we were, you know, quite open about this. I mean, there was one point after the Iranian Revolution, during the Reagan administration, when the Kuwaiti tankers were coming under attack from Iran. You know, Iran is right there at the Straits of Hormuz, where they were coming under attack from Iranian gunboats. And so we reflagged them as American tankers and took the U.S. fleet in there. And Reagan created CENTCOM, and I think it was either 83, 84, 85, but anyway, somewhere there in the early to mid-80s, created CENTCOM to protect our oil supplies. Now we've created, Bush has created AFRICOM to protect oil supplies, U.S. oil supplies in Africa. We're competing with the Chinese for African oil. We're competing with Russia for oil from the Caspian region, from the Caucasus Mountains, from the oil-rich and oil-producing areas of south of Russia and north of Turkey and Greece. And the direct result and Turkey and Armenia rather. And that is, by the way, Georgia. There is a major oil pipeline running right through Georgia where a lot of that oil is being transported over to the Black Sea where it can get to the West. And I'm telling you, what's going on here is Russia is saying, "We are going to control this oil." And the thing that makes this so dangerous is that we may well be saying, given that we have, going all the way back to Franklin Roosevelt, through Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, Nixon, because we ignored Jimmy Carter, because Reagan became president and rolled back the Carter Doctrine of stopping the U.S. dependence on foreign oil, and instead increased our addiction to foreign oil to the point where we're now at 60%, and according to the administration, according to Cheney's own energy administration, his own energy policy study group, we're going to have 70% of our oil imported within the next 15 years. Now we're so addicted to this that we're having to use military force all over the world. What are we going to do? If the Russians end up controlling the oil out of the Caspian Sea and that whole region of the world, if the Chinese end up controlling the oil in Africa, they've already cut the deal with the Sudanese, they're cutting deals all over Africa, we've got Nigeria in the bag, but there's others that are in play. If the Russians and Chinese end up controlling this oil, we are going to be really screwed. So now is the time that instead of saying we're going to play belligerent, we're going to fight, we're going to kick ass, we're going to take that oil, now is the time that we need to do a Manhattan Project to become oil independent. It's not going to happen under this administration, but we need to be planning for it now.
You're listening to Tom Hartmann. Call him now at 866-303-2270.
So here's my point. We have had a foreign policy since 1945 that has been dependent in large part on protecting the oil supplies from the Middle East. It has led us into increased addiction and dependency to those oil supplies. And the consequence of that, and the only president to have seriously pushed back on that was Jimmy Carter. And he was ignored. I mean, he was actually successful in getting the legislation passed, but, you know, if the October surprise, the fall of the Shah, the taking of the hostages, the whole October surprise thing that Reagan and Bill Casey put together, threw him out of office. Reagan came in, rolled it back, and said, no, we're going to continue, you know, let the good times roll. It's just like the Republican tax and spend, borrow and spend policies. It's the pump and use policies. And what I'm saying is that what we need to be doing right now, we need to be doing a whole series of things like the Germans are doing, where they're saying, if you put solar panels on your roof, then the bank, we will subsidize the banks. Well, actually, we will protect them. They'll make a profit. They give you a loan at 2%, a 10-year mortgage at 2%, and it's guaranteed profit to them because we'll 100% back them up. So they're not going to lose money on it. But they're not going to make a lot of money, but they're not going to lose money. So you get a 2% mortgage for 10 years to solarize your house. And then any electricity that you create from your home that is in excess of what you're using runs your meter backwards, and you sell to the power company. The power company must buy it from you at 7 times the retail rate, because that's the cost over a 10-year period of building a new power plant. Is 7 times the retail rate of all the users. That 7 times the retail rate happens to be the same amount of money as the mortgage would cost. So basically, selling the electricity pays off the mortgage. At the end of 10 years, you simply sell it back to the power company at 100% of their cost to you. In other words, it's just like normal. And you own the solar system so that everybody in the country now has solar panels on their roofs. Germany, in the last 10 years, has been able to generate so much solar power with this program that they have not had to build 2 new nuclear power plants. And they're actually winding down the ones they have. Denmark is producing 19% of their electricity from wind power now. They're talking about having the government subsidize the Danish auto manufacturers to manufacture electric cars that will plug into the grid during the day at work and feed power into the grid during maximum demand for electricity time. And then at night, when the wind is blowing just fine, thank you very much, but nobody needs electricity, those cars will be recharged while they're at home, and they'll be taking that wind power down and storing it. So all the millions of cars in Denmark become a giant, massive electrical storage system. They're moving ahead on this. I mean, these are the things that we need to do. If we were to drill in Anwar tomorrow, if we were to say, okay to the oil companies, drill in Anwar, it's all yours. It's going to take them 5 to 10 years before they can even get their act together, number one. Number two, it won't be enough oil to make any kind of significant difference. We're talking, we're using 20 million barrels of oil a day. It's going to go, at current trends, it's going to go to 25 million barrels a day within 15 or 20 years. Although, frankly, I don't think those trends are going to continue. But let's say it just stays at 20 million barrels a day. And right now, you know, 11, 12, 13, 14 million barrels of that is imported. Say we can get a 500,000 barrels a day out of the North Slope, which would be generous. I mean, the most optimistic estimates anybody would put forward, particularly given the constraints of a pipeline, is 800,000. It's less than 1 million barrels a day. We are consuming 20 million barrels a day. It's a drop in the bucket, and at that pump rate, by the way, it would only last 7 years. But it wouldn't even be available for 10 years. Solar panels are available today. Windmills are available today. Local communities can go energy independent today. This is a crisis, and I'm telling you, the war in Georgia is about the Soviet Union following the Reagan policy of saying, we're going to use oil, we're going to control the world's oil. And China's militarization, China's military is growing faster than any military of any country on earth, and next year they're going to surpass us as the largest manufacturing force on the planet. Their economy is going to be larger than ours, their military will soon be larger than ours, and we're going to be facing, if we continue down this road of saying that our goal is to be, our job is to be the nation's policeman, and we're doing it to protect our oil supplies, we are screwed. We are going to see World War III writ large. And the conflict in Georgia right now is I was going to say the first indicator of it. Actually, I'd say the war in Iraq. Bush's war oil war in Iraq is the first indicator. Georgia is the second. We are now seeing, back in 1994, 1995, the book was published in 96. I wrote Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. And in that book in 1995, I wrote, within a decade, we will be seeing wars for oil. And here we are. 866-303-2270. David in Beverly Hills. Hey, David.
Hey, Tom. Just for a second, in 1982, I was in Israel, and I stayed with my uncle, who was relatively poor and had a little shack of a house. And at that time, they had solar panels on their roofs, and they still do.
Oh, yeah, all over Israel. And not just Israel, but Israel's the leader in this. It's for water heating, yeah.
Yeah, for water heating.
Virtually all the hot water in Israel is provided by solar power.
Exactly. And when they discovered oil in 1867, what was it used for 40 years before the automobile came around?
They refined it to kerosene and replaced whale oil. And it was a fortuitous thing, too, because by the 1840s, we had pretty much fished out the whale populations around the world, and whale oil prices were doubling and tripling about every 4 or 5 years. And so whale oil, which was the principal source of nighttime illumination in the United States, had become very, very expensive. And beeswax was just, you know, the price was out of sight. And so it was used mostly for lighting in the early 1860s and 1870s. By the 1880s, they started using it for home heating.
And now we're running out of oil, and the same thing's happening.
There you go.
Exactly
right. Thanks a lot for the call, David. Eugene in Los Angeles. Hey, Eugene.
Yes. I would like to say something fresh here. This war in Georgia is not about oil, not primarily. Please let me explain. I'm from the former Soviet Union, and hello?
Yeah, I'm listening.
I'm sorry. In 1920 and in 1994, when Russia was weak, the Georgians were ethnically cleansing Ossetians.
Yes.
And Russia was protecting them these last 15 years with peacekeepers.
Right. No, I understand that.
Please, let me finish. It's very hard to get on the radio here, to get on the phone here. On Friday, Georgian tanks were rolling in. First of all, the airplanes were bombing the city, including hospitals. When people went into the cellars, the tanks went into the city, and they were shooting at the residential houses. And after them were coming Georgian infantry, and they were throwing grenades into the cellars. That's first of all. Second of all, there are about 150 American military advisors there. Mm-hmm. And Georgia's military budget since 2003, when Saakashvili came to power, rose 30 times.
Mm-hmm.
30 times.
No, I am not disagreeing with you. I agree that South Ossetia and Abkhazia,
yeah.
These two regions have been semi-autonomous since 1994. Russia has been actually issuing passports to their citizens. They consider themselves Russians and part of Russia. And Saakashvili, the president of Georgia, said, no, we're going to try and take this back.
And
there is a debate, Eugene, you realize, between who fired...
And also Saakashvili and all the other government officials are making speeches on Georgian television in English, not Georgian.
Yeah, and you know, I understand. And the Russian take on this is Saakashvili started this by trying to take back these breakaway republics, which we consider to be ethnically Russian. Georgian.
It's not Russia's take. It's a fact.
No, it may well be. It may well be, Eugene.
Yeah.
But the point is, the reason why Russia figures that this is a fight worth fighting, the reason why Russia is willing to put a stick in our eye, the reason why I think Russia is not going to stop at Ossetia and Abkhazia is because and that they're going to take Georgia is because of the pipeline. Exactly. That's the thing that makes this all worth the fight and worth alienating the United States.
And here's something else. Georgia, in the second half of the 18th century, asked Russia to protect it from Turkey.
Yeah.
From the Turks. Now what's happening? Turkey is arming Georgia along with United States. And
right. Because Turkey wants to be part of NATO, too.
Israel stopped all its military orders to Georgia because they're disagreeing with it. They're siding with Russia. Israel is.
That's interesting. I didn't know that, Eugene. Yeah. I can't say, you know, I can't absolutely qualify any of the. See, the problem is that it certainly appears that Georgia provoked this and that Russia, you know, fought back. But the story is always more complex than that. But the big picture here, the important thing here, is that the reason why this region could be the Archduke Ferdinand, the assassination of whom in Sarajevo started World War I. The reason this region could be the Archduke Ferdinand is because it is the epicenter of the second or third largest supply of oil in the world. It is the Saudi Arabia of the Caucasus. And we've got to tread very lightly there. 45 minutes past the hour.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Is in China. Dick Cheney comes out with the official position, this statement. I'm not seeing this anywhere in the news. This is a Reuters story, but all the media is reporting how the administration is saying, oh, let's be cautious. And, you know, Dick Cheney says, and I quote, Russian aggression must not go unanswered. His office issued a statement saying the vice president expressed called President Mikhail Chakavili is Saakashvili and said the vice president expressed the United States' solidarity with the Georgian people and their democratically elected government in the face of this threat to Georgia's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Russian aggression must not go unanswered, and that its continuation, Russian aggression's continuation, will have serious consequences for its relationships with the United States as well as the broader international community. I personally don't think that this is a war that we should be involved in. And if we want to prevent ourselves from being involved in dozens more, we need to get off oil now. Nathan in Coral Springs, Florida, you want to disagree with me?
Yeah, I want to disagree. I mean, I agree with you about the solar energy. I would even call the agency Sunny May, you know, low interest loans,
sure,
things like that. I installed solar water heaters when I was a kid in the 1970s in Florida. So I'm all for that. But I don't think we're going to, with China and India coming on board, I think we should have a multifaceted. We need to drill a lot, not just Anwar, a lot. Because you're right. You have to add all the military stuff to the cost of oil, and we don't really do that.
You know the largest consumer of our oil right now in the United States?
Yeah, I believe it's the military.
That's right. And if we said, okay, we're not going to be the world's policeman anymore, we're not going to spend $160 billion a year protecting oil routes into the United States because we're no longer going to use oil, we're going to use solar and wind, then we really wouldn't need to do all that drilling.
I don't agree. I think that petroleum is a very useful chemical for a lot of different applications.
Sure, and let's leave it in the ground until we actually need it, rather than waste it on transportation that can be done with other forms of energy.
And I also believe that, well, you know, Tom, I don't know whether you own an electric car, but I've driven in one, and there really are pieces of junk.
Yeah.
And
well,
you wouldn't want it for a regular basis.
And so was the Model T, Nathan. Everything starts out at the bottom. No, I've been driving hybrid cars now for years, and they're not pieces of junk. They're very efficient and get great gas mileage. I'm sorry. I think that you're making my case. Kirsten in Aberdeen, Washington. Hey, Kirsten.
Oh, peace be to you. I've been in such prayer this morning. About four nights ago, I learned on a late-night talk show that the Queen of the Netherlands owns a 70% interest in the Shell pipeline that passes through that region. And what it led me to think about was also Ferdinand's involvement, as you said earlier, in that war. And again, we have somewhat of an involvement, or maybe more than somewhat, with the Queen of the Netherlands. And
well, that's the Royal Dutch Shell Company.
Yeah.
Shell Oil is in part, I don't know that it's 70%, but in part is owned by the Dutch royal family. But the point is that it almost doesn't matter because oil is so fungible. If it shows up in one place, it ends up someplace else. It's moving around constantly. You know, the worldwide supply of oil is really the bottom line. But, you know, interesting point. Ron in California. Hey, Ron.
Hey, Tom, thank you for your show. I wanted to just say that having Americans truly understand what happened in those secret energy meetings,
right.
I don't know about anybody else. That has become such an importance to me. That I believe we need to start there. I don't know how we move forward with of actually demanding. And I mean demanding what went on in those secret energy meetings with Dick Cheney and whoever it was.
Well, we know that Ken Lay was there. We know that Rex Tillerson was there. We know the head of ExxonMobil, Ken Lay, the head of Enron. And we know that the head of Chevron was there. That's all we know. And we know that Dick Cheney said in a press conference that he did not want input from any, or maybe it was Bush, that they didn't want any input from any of those fringe groups like the crazy environmentalists. That was the phrase, as I recall, that they used. So, and the energy policy statement that came out was pretty explicit. Number one, we needed to beef up our military to protect our oil supplies around the world. Number two, we needed to drill in Anwar. It was all oil, and more oil, and more subsidies for the oil companies and for big nuclear. I mean, this is the tragedy. This is the tragedy of having two oil men as president and vice president of the United States. Mike in Portland, a minute before we got to wrap up the show here, Mike. What's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I was just going to say that there was a time when our leaders couldn't imagine an America that could survive without slave labor, but we did, and we just need good leadership now.
Yeah, and there was a time when we couldn't imagine when we couldn't the ability to survive without whale oil, and there was a time when we couldn't imagine, you know. And what about the buggy whip manufacturers? You know, we were very concerned about them around 1900, and on it goes. Mike, excellent point. I mean, the history of America is the history of adaptation and innovation. I lived in Vermont for almost 10 years and saw pictures in a state that's covered with trees right now, and saw pictures of Vermont in the 1880s. Now, this was the year that the railroads first started bringing coal up to Vermont. And you look at those pictures of Vermont in the 1880s, the entire state was naked. There wasn't a tree standing anywhere because they'd all been used for heat. And then came the coal. I mean, we are constantly changing our energy sources. It's time for us to do it again. Tomorrow, George Landreth, president of Frontiers of Freedom. We're going to be talking about Exxon profits. Larry Pratt, Gun Owners of America. We'll be talking about guns and, of course, the best of the rest of the news. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great week. Have a great evening.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmannRadio.com.